Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I am your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Jake Taylor, a repeat guest of the pod, my co-host on Value After Hours, all-around good dude. Jake has developed a product called Journalytic, J-O-U-R-N-A-L-Y-T-I-C. Journalytic is a free software that you can use to improve your investment process. You can monitor a bunch of things about how you go through researching an idea. You can have checklists. You can have a bunch of stuff. You will hear about it in the podcast. This podcast is more or less an infomercial for Journalytic. Why'd I do it? I did it because I believe in Jake. I think Journalytic's a great product. It's free. You can try it out. If you hate it, don't use it. If you love it, keep using it. Either way, send Jake feedback. He's looking for it. I'm looking to help him. I hope you all enjoy this. He's a guy that's worth supporting. So that's the episode in a nutshell. Another potential product is offered by the sponsor of this episode, Stratosphere.io. Stratosphere.io is a web-based terminal that has financial data, KPIs, links to filings, hedge fund letters, etc. Stratosphere.io provides clean data for segment data KPIs, which are triple checked for accuracy. I use it. I like it. I encourage you to check it out. Should you want to sign up for some of the more premium features, please use the promo code BREW, B-R-E-W, for a 15% off discount. I am like Santa Claus bringing you all this free stuff this weekend, and you're welcome. And I'm doing it because I appreciate your time. I appreciate you listening to the show. Please know that this is for entertainment purposes only. Anything we say should be checked against your own due diligence. You know the drill. I don't actually think we need many disclaimers in this particular episode. So do your own due diligence. Enjoy the show. And, happy holidays to everybody. With that out of the way, enjoy the show. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are joined again by Jake Taylor. Big announcement, but first you're going to get to hear us talk about why this is just audio only. So, yeah, anyway, the last couple episodes have been audio because, you know, I wasn't in the house. I was off location. So, I mean, the retention numbers, it's very, very similar. It turns out I think people care about the quality of the discussion and not whether or not they can see us talk.
I think that's correct. And they're certainly not missing much. I wanted to know whether I should do my hair or not.
Well, what time is it where you are? Is it 6 a.m.?
It is 6 a.m., yeah.
Yeah, man. You were ready to go. As soon as I said, let's do it at 9 a.m., I was like, Jake's in California. That's not exactly thoughtful of me. And then you were like, no, I'll be up. So no worries.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little harder to wake up in the wintertime when it's still dark, but usually I'm up pretty early.
Yeah. Well, that's part of why you're a productive member of society, I think.
I mean, it's a joke, but it's also when the rest of the family is asleep is like my golden time where like the really good work gets done. Good thoughts happen. It's not so noisy and distracting around here. So there is something to be said about that.
You know what I've been dealing with lately is I came to the conclusion, it was an upsetting conclusion, that my wife is correct.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, I know. And it happens like all the time, which is unfortunate for me. But she kept being like, you're not. I think what she was trying to tell me, and probably did tell me, but I refused to listen, was that I'm not present enough when I'm around, right? And I was like, no, I am here. But, you know, I've taken the podcast off when I've been around the family. I've been fishing with the kids more. I've been more present. It's been really nice. I don't know. And I actually think my productivity has gone up quite a bit because I think I'm like disconnecting better each way. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that's something this work from home has revealed a little bit of some problems for me in a way that I didn't anticipate, which was that even when the kids are at school, you know, and it's just my wife and I, we're both working from home, it sounds like, oh, you're going to have all this like chance to interact with each other because you're both home. But it turns out I feel like we're having a lot of low quality interactions and a lot less high quality interactions. So we have the quantity is higher, but they're like, you know, throwaway, like you're getting coffee in the kitchen and so am I. And, you know, you just like complain about some little thing or I do. And then like we go back to our respective little offices. But that's not really the stuff that you know, like a good marriage is built on necessarily. I don't know. It feels like it's not as much as I was hoping it would be potentially when it came to that.
Yeah. And then I think what may happen is like the mental association when you're seeing somebody and you're getting like those low quality interactions, it kind of like, I don't know, it solidifies that maybe it's not a low quality interaction relationship, but I do think that like it chips away at how your mind frames the relationship.
Yeah. And I mean, just like anything, that if you're, you know, the diminishing returns, like being around me that much, it's going to start to not be that great. But if I was at work all day and then I come home and you only have to deal with me for a few hours, like that might be somewhat pleasant. So yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm certain being around me all the time is not that fun because I have to be around myself all the time and it's a torture.
It's just a grind.
Yeah, it really is. Well, man, I am super happy for you and I could not be happier to do this episode. And I hope that, you know, people try the product once we talk about it. But it's exciting to see you come out with Journalytic publicly. And you want to talk about what Journalytic is. And people asked me once, they said, like, how much time do you think Jake put into this? And I said, I think it's probably a decade of thinking constantly about this. So I think you're the right guy for the right product. And I'm happy to feature you. So you want to go into it?
I appreciate that, Bill. And I mean, how long have we been talking about it behind the scenes? I mean, it's been
a long time.
At least a few years, right?
Yeah. And I would say before like even the product existed, we talked about you wanting a product like this,
yeah.
Right? And then you built it.
Right. Yeah. And that's really the impetus of the whole thing was that if this existed already out there and was easy to use, I would have gladly just bought that product from whoever had built it and gone on my merry way, probably.
Yeah. So what is the product for people that don't know?
Yeah, I mean, it's a journaling and note-taking and decision recording and hopefully de-biasing based on the structure of it software that lets you basically get all your thoughts in there, get them organized, record decisions, and really like capture a bunch of data about your investment process that is currently going most likely unrecorded that could have huge impacts on closing feedback loops so that you learn about yourself and so that you discover where you are making systematic errors and hopefully maybe be able to take some correction.
And then it provides you. So like one of the things that I really liked about, you know, when we were talking about it is you have, you know, how am I feeling about this investment? And then you can look at a stock chart and you can see every time you input, how am I feeling about this? You can kind of take a step back and say, okay, well, do I feel good when the stock goes up and do I feel bad when it goes down? How much of that's reality? I would think some of that's correlated because usually stocks don't go up and down when things, you know, they usually move with news, right? But it helps put data to feelings.
Right. And like one of the issues is that there can often be a lot of recency bias in. If you feel bad about it, let's say the price went down and now we're looking at the next 10Q or whatever, the next update that comes in, we have this layer of negativity, what psychology researchers would call affect, about the new incoming data. And that's going to bias us towards like finding the negative thing and finding the, like, why is this glass half empty now? And it may be justified a lot of the times, like, but it also might not be. And that's when real opportunity is that when Klarman talks about investing being the marriage of a calculator and a, what was the other part of it? It was a contrarian streak and a calculator, right? So the calculator part is actually processing the data correctly and not having that bias in the way based on what the price has been doing or what social media has been saying or all the million like echo chambers that we all kind of live in that will bias us towards possibly not seeing reality clearly.
Yeah. I guess, how has it helped you as you built it out? I mean, for those that haven't checked it out, first of all, it's free, so there's no excuse not to. Second of all, there's a lot of checklists in it. It's very customizable. If you want to do your own checklist, you can check out, you know, okay. One of the things I thought was really interesting that you said is like, when you think that when your justification for making an investment is that the stock is cheap, you have found that the data maybe says it wasn't as cheap as you thought it was, right? And being able to have that feedback is super valuable.
Yeah. I mean, it the software is free to use. However, it's not completely free. And what I mean by that is there are a few prerequisites that are important probably for a user to keep in mind. Number one is that you have to have a growth mindset coming into it. If you don't think that you can get better, then there's kind of no point in working on all this stuff. But if you do believe that you have the ability to get better, then I think that this could be really helpful. Number two is that you have to have a willingness to work a little bit. Like, it takes work to record a lot of this stuff and capture it in the software. And so if you're generally kind of lazy, then I would say, maybe this will help you get to recording more. But if you're so lazy that you don't want to record anything, then it's kind of hard to really help. And then the last thing is that I think it requires a little bit of someone who has some self-honesty and like wants to be introspective about their process and get better. So if you don't have those three things, then it's probably not for you. And that's okay. Like, it doesn't have to be for everybody. But for the person who does like measuring things about themselves and does want to get better and believes they can get better, then I think the suite of tools that we've put together are super valuable for that. So I probably should have prefaced that at the very beginning of the interview so that if someone fell into the other camp, they can, just tune off now.
Yeah. I feel bad if you listened to Jake's pitch right there and said, yeah, I'm really a person that doesn't want to get any better. It's going to be tough to be a good investor if that's where you fall. But, whatever, be honest with yourself, right?
So what you were referring to was the idea that when you record a decision in Journalytic, you can attach to it a reason code. And this can be, broad level, whatever you want it to be. You can put in customize. We have some presets. But what's interesting is once you've built up an inventory of decisions that you've been making, and I've been, recording in here for a good 18 months and even going back further and backdating some decisions. But even then, I'm a little suspect of those because you can't be exactly sure what you were thinking at that time.
Yeah.
Now, prospectively, when I go and I look at that time period where I've been diligent about recording them, there's some patterns that are starting to emerge in my decision making based on the reason code. And then how did that basket of reason codes go on to perform? So it's about tying those feedback loops of what works and what doesn't for you. And, it's still probably a little bit early in the data set to draw too many conclusions, but I know that the path that I'm on is leading me to a place where I'm going to have a very nice data set of that I can look back on and figure out when I go wrong, like, is there a consistent reason that keeps leading me to going wrong?
Yeah, I know you have thought, but have you thought about ways of getting like case studies in so that people can get more reps on the data?
Yeah, I mean, I've daydreamed about like, God, imagine if Buffett had been filling out diligently a Journalytic account for like 50 years, and then picture that as a data set that you could go read about and look at, and just like the treasure trove that would be. The idea that there would be somebody eventually who, never probably going to be as good as Buffett, but even if they were pretty good and they used it for a long time, they could show like what they've worked on and how they've grown. But I mean, it's other than putting in just like dummy decisions, which I actually don't think it's that helpful for. I mean, it's okay to see the mechanics for someone like of how it works, but to actually get those deep insights, like we're going so far into sort of your thought processes that I almost think you can't kind of like just create those out of thin air and then end up with the ingredients that would show some kind of true insight. I think it almost has to emerge as a natural process.
Yeah. And I think the other thing, it may be difficult, like if you're a listener and you haven't checked it out, it may be difficult to say, okay, well, I don't make that many investment decisions a year. One way that I think that you can increase the reps and you're not juking the stats is like, I've been researching Dish lately and it is not an equity that I'm going to buy right now, but that is a decision, right? So the decisions to not purchase things are decisions.
Yeah. So looking at one of the categories in there is a pass decision. And so looking at all of the reason codes that you could use about passing, you'll start to have feedback on what does the filtration system look like? Where are you systematically screening out winners and losers as well, which might be like self-reinforcing to tell you like, oh, this is something I believe, like maybe for me, for instance, like too much leverage is a potential line item. And I don't actually know the answer to that one yet. It's possible that I have had a bias against too much leverage that has hurt me in the long run, but we'll find out eventually together probably. So being able to see how your filters are impacting your decision-making, but also like you said, like if you record a decision that you're passing for now while you're researching more, that can actually have information in it as well as to like what is the opportunity cost of spending more and more time to research. Like what's possible is that there's some small subset of companies where like you just get it right away and like those turn into like really good investments. And it would tell you almost like, oh man, the time that I spent on all of this other research that didn't really take me anywhere. And a lot of times I just talk myself into some kind of bullshit stuff. Like that's good to know about yourself, I think. So, you know, it almost force you into realizing like, oh my God, sometimes there's no brainers and sometimes there aren't. And occasionally, if I work hard enough, like I'll find some unique insight. But often if it doesn't come soon enough, then that means that like I'm forcing it too much, which is something that I think can happen. But you don't really know any answers to these things until you have data about them. I mean, we're all just sort of guessing at it. And we remember like one or two big ones, you know, like, but we don't really have the full base rate of decisions to see what the scoring would look like.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like, you know, you can either hashtag the equity or you can hashtag who you got the information from. So I'm just going to use Dish because I've been working through it with that currently. Right. I had put out the Craig Moffett episode and somebody from Twitter pinged me and said, I think you're blind, potentially blind to what Dish is doing. So I said, okay, like that may make sense. Right. And then I started to go through and I put in Journalytic. Where did I get this idea from? Why am I interested in it? Like stuff like that. And we'll see, you know, was I blind for a good reason? Was I not blind? Or, you know, whatever it is, I do think that person was correct to highlight that I should do the research, you know, and I think if I were to buy it today, it would be because it's cheap. One of the reasons that I said that I'm not buying it is I'd like to see the business transformation work a little bit longer. And, you know, it's got a little too much leverage for me. So I've coded all that stuff and we'll see.
So what's really great is you can record that decision and then have it say like pass for now. And then you could record a self-contract where you set the parameters of what you would like to see right now while you're thinking clearly about it, while it's all kind of loaded in RAM in your head. And then set a trigger for that so that eventually if you like, ideally someday I'm going to have this programmed where like you can set price alerts. Like that's kind of obvious. Like there's a lot of places you can do that. And you could set even maybe valuation alerts. So that's oftentimes like if the company you're interested in, you like the business, but it's too expensive for your tastes. You have it as sort of an inventory item that if it ever got down to a certain valuation, I'd be interested in it. So setting a valuation and having that trigger for you and send you an alert. But what I'd really like to do is someday having it be even a little smarter than that and have some AI be able to look at it and look at what you said the trigger was and see if it can kind of back into what that might be based on the words that it might see in an 8K, for instance. So,
yeah,
you know, let's say for me personally, like I'm not a big fan of management repricing their options. Okay. That should not actually be that difficult for a computer to parse in an 8K when it comes out or in the proxy. So, and having it then alert me when that happens and I could say, oh shit, this is like a deal breaker for me. And now I know about it right away. And I pre-programmed already in a contract with myself that I was just going to punch out if this happened, because that meant to me, there are cockroaches in the kitchen and I, you know, who knows how many there are.
Yeah. That's interesting. So, you know, with Dish, my perception of what is going to happen or should happen is there are three things. One, they need to probably merge Dish and DirecTV. Two, they need to divest the prepaid business. And three, they need to acquire some customers in a postpaid wireless product on consumer. And I guess the fourth is, let's see what they do in enterprise. So it would be interesting to say, this is my self-contract of when I'd like to revisit this idea, right? Say Dish and DirecTV merge. And then have Journalytic ping me and say, hey, you said this to yourself. What are you thinking now? Right. And it just kind of forces you to stay on top of things.
Right. So you could set a reminder in there now and like, you know, check back on this in 6 months. We actually built a inactivity alert. So for me, like you don't want to go too long without like looking at something you own again. And but it's really easy for, you know, a quarter or two to go by sometimes without checking back in on things. And so this will, if you don't do a journal entry about an item, you could set it either like 30 or 90 days. It will ping you and say, hey, you've been inactive on this name for 90 days. Should you make a journal entry and like do a little digging again?
You know, it's a powerful tool for individuals, but I would think it's even more powerful for institutions because you get more reps right? Just by definition, you have more people, you get more reps, you get more data.
Yeah, we're not there yet. I mean, that's something we're working on. Like, how do we turn this from a single player game into a multiplayer game? And when we do that, I think it's going to be very powerful. And actually, a lot of the data that is interesting at a single individual investor level gets even more interesting at a multiple user level, and how people interact and all of that stuff. Like, it's just a whole nother degree of freedom of measurement that's super interesting. One of the things you've said a couple times is about like getting reps. And one of the problems with the whole investing game is that to truly score yourself and figure out luck versus skill, if you were to do it based on price only, which is basically returns, which is kind of what everyone only uses, if you look at only returns, it's probably a good decade before we could say with a whole lot of really any certainty, but probably not even that much certainty, do you have luck or do you have skill? One way to bring that timeline in is to make probabilistic predictions about business fundamentals and then score those and get a much higher data set as to the accuracy of your ability to understand the truth of any business. So, you know, you could be making a revenue, a margin, a multiple, a dividend yield, a share count prediction for every single one price entry that you would have over a period of time. And so we could really start to ramp up the data set of what you could look at as to the predictions. And so, you know, why probabilistic? Well, that is going to, over time, tell you how accurately calibrated are you? Are you overconfident? If you're overconfident, then you are thinking that things are going to happen a lot more often, and then you end up being wrong when you thought you were going to be right. You know, let's say you said it was a 90% chance that this company was going to grow revenue 10%. Well, that means 9 out of 10 times of that type of data, it should happen. And if it doesn't, and let's say it comes in at like 50, well, that's really good to know about yourself, that you tend to be over-optimistic about how much companies are going to grow. And, you know, and any one of those, like, you can do it for any KPI or whatever measurement that you want that you feel like makes sense for that business. But I think we could all probably do a little bit more of focusing on the business and the fundamentals there and making projections about those data points, and less just following what the price is saying and getting our one per year data entry on, you know, what did the price do this year?
Yeah. Yeah, and you can break down returns into multiple expansion. Mm-hmm. Did you predict that or did you not predict that?
Yeah, how am I going to win?
Get a little more honest with yourself.
Yeah, exactly right. And that's really, I mean, at the end of the day, like that was all I wanted out of a tool, was like, hold the mirror up. Like, don't let me retell history that I thought something was going to happen a certain way. And then when it didn't, my mind went back and like patched it over so that it protected my ego at the end of the day. Like, that's what our brains are trying to do there. We want to think that we can make sense of the world, and it's very threatening to imagine that we can't make sense of it. So, you know, I mean, our brains are just trying to help us out and do what they think is best. But if you want to get at the fundamental truth of anything, then you have to record things in high fidelity and not let your memory like rewrite history.
I think something that is going to be important to people, because we touched on multiplayer games and whatnot, and I mentioned institutions, data security. Can you see what people are putting into the platform, and how are you thinking about other people's work product?
I wish I could, because it would be infinitely fascinating. But the answer is no. The data are encrypted at the browser level on your computer locally, transmitted, and then on our servers, which are at Google's servers cloud, it's encrypted at rest, it's called. So it's basically like no one can get into it. It's as good as the security as we can possibly do. And so we can't see anything. And we do have a tool that's really, it's kind of fun to see. It lets you watch what a user is doing, but it redacts all of the data and, like, you know, fuzzies it out. So you kind of see like where people are clicking around, where are they getting stuck, like what are they working on? But you can't actually see any of the real data that would be market sensitive at all.
Yeah. The checklist, I'm very excited to bring that into my, you know, I have done checklists in the past. I'm very excited to see how I interact with, to your point, holding the mirror up and going through a full-blown checklist, even if it says, you know, this doesn't apply here, just making myself go through it. And then I like it in software form, because you really can't lie to yourself, right? It's not paper where you can be like, I wrote that or whatever. It's like that.
So, I mean, this is my original checklist that I did before Journalytic was a 40-page Word doc that was just different line items, and it would have stories like, you know, here's where someone else messed up. Like, it was always about trying to avoid mistakes and bring blind spots to awareness. And the problem is when it was just written out like that, like, I would just kind of blow through it. And like, I wasn't really thinking deeply about each thing. And you kind of don't actually think through something unless you have to write it down also. Like, there has to be some activity taken that really like closes that loop somewhat. So with their checklist, like, we have 45 different categories of checklists already built in with more than 300 items. And, you know, they're all over the place. From, we have famous investors checklists who we have just scoured the internet and found, you know, all the people who you might want to see. And then, you know, all the way from like accounting red flags to, we built the software. It's mostly aimed towards public equities. Just, that's probably my own biases and scratching my own itch more than anything. But we do have custom assets that you can create, whether it's, you know, a real estate property or private equity or a, you know, venture capital, whatever you want. And there's some checklists about those asset classes as well in there. So we wanted it to be a little bit more flexible. So if you were running a family office or whatever, like, you, and you have money with a manager, like, you could create a custom asset for a particular manager that, you know, an LP that you're a part of. And we didn't want to have it not work for you in that instance. Because a lot of all these same decision making, all that criteria, everything is pretty comparable, whether you're deciding to invest in an individual security or a manager or a piece of property or a, you know, a startup or whatever it is. All that hygiene that you're trying to get better at is still all totally applicable. So
it's very neat. How did you get, like, I really believe you're the right person for this product. So how did you get so, I would say, almost obsessed with process? And like, where does that come from?
That's a good question. And I'm the right person only if Michael Mobison is already busy, only if Phil Tetlock or Annie Duke or Daniel Kahneman, if they're already, you know, busy working on other things, then maybe I might be okay. But
yeah, but okay. So you say that, but like, all good ideas are, I mean, I don't know that there's any new good ideas, right? They're all somewhat borrowed. And what I think you've done with this product is go through those kinds of thinkers and say, okay, how can I automate, for lack of a better term, or put into software form what I've learned from these people?
I don't know where the like focus on process has come from. It might be poetic justice or like actually a beautiful nudge from the universe in that, you know, value sucking for a long time will make you check all of your assumptions. Whatever your investment process is, when, if it doesn't work for a long period of time, that will make you get back to like, let's strip this thing down to the studs and figure out, do I still know what the hell I'm doing? Am I like totally off base? And so perhaps that forcing function of value being facing quite a headwind for several years and relatively early in my career, that will push me to probably be a little bit more introspective. And if everything was just working, you know, right out of the gates, like, it's kind of easy to just imagine you're smart and there's, you know, it's like, well, yeah, of course it was going to work. Like, I'm smart. So this is, you know, I'm good at this.
Yeah.
But if it's not working, you really are like, okay, well, shit, what do I actually have control over here? And the answer that I came to realize was that process was the only thing that I really had control over. Can I just get a little bit better about making a little bit better decisions every single day? And maybe, you know, like, obviously Munger's mentality of going to bed a little smarter than you woke up is kind of baked into that mindset. And so how could I force myself to do that? And I found that having forcing functions is really important. Like, I made a joke on Twitter at one point that, you know, learning about the investment process for me, my version was naturally curious is one level of sort of like pushing you to understand. And then teaching a class, which I did for a number of years, was a great forcing function to really learn deeply. And then writing a book was another level down of forcing me to like really think through something and like get to all the like base first principle assumptions that are involved in that exercise. And then making software for something is that next level down, because it just requires so much turning this like Rubik's Cube, you know, over and over until you fully understand all the outline of how it fits into the rest of what you're trying to accomplish. So I don't know. That's a long answer with not much of a real answer in it, but that's been my journey at least for the last decade.
Well, you know, for people that don't know, I don't know who listens to me that doesn't listen to Value After Hours, but whoever you are, I appreciate the support.
Love you too.
Yeah, that's right. But like, you know, you are the guy that comes on the show and you do the veggie segments is what we call them, you know, eat your veggies. And it's been a lot about process. And I think that on that particular show, we all have our own character sort of roles that we play. But your character role is very, very aligned with how you are day in and day out. And I'm just super excited for this product. I don't know how you're going to make money. Have you figured that out? I mean, if you're giving all this away for free, you know, it's a cost center for you. And I don't know where the revenue is coming from, but I have a feeling that'll work itself out over time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I honestly don't know the answer yet, which is always a little scary, but I have an amazing team around me with this project. That was another thing that starting this out, like other things that I've done before, you know, whether it was managing money or writing a book or whatever, I've tended to keep most like it very closely held and own most of the equity and pretty much like guarded that closely. And I decided before even I had like before I imagined Journalic being a business, I said my next project I'm going to just open up to the universe of like who wants to work together, who wants to raise their hand, and when they say yes and I like them and they like me, then like we're just gonna like make some shit happen. And so I had that mentality coming into this project, and it's like the people that it's attracted to work with us, and you know, I have two other co-founders who are amazing, and I've got three awesome employees that are just like grinding nonstop and really passionate about it. So we'll figure it out as the short answer. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a challenge to imagine like what's the right feature set. Like part of it is figuring out exactly who's using the product and what else can we build for them that they would be so in love with that they would never imagine wanting to use another service for it. And they'd be so happy to write that check or credit card payment every month or whatever to keep the service going and feeling like they were ripping me off at that point. And that's what I'm aiming for.
Yeah. Well, you're always talking about Peter Kaufman's win-win-win concept. And I know that that's where this is going eventually. You know, our mutual friend Chaz, I mean, he raves about what Journalytics done for him. And I think part of why I wanted to do this podcast with you too is, you know, we've talked about this. You're not somebody that said like, I have found the ultimate product and this is the end state of the product, right? You're actively soliciting feedback. That's part of why it's free. So I hope that some of the listeners that adopt it, because in case you haven't heard three times, it's free, you know, reach out to you and give you some feedback on what they'd like to see.
Yeah, all feedback is welcome, good and bad. I mean, it helps make the product better. And, you know, Chaz has been really awesome and great to get to know. And one of the things that he really impresses upon us is that actually some of the like the feeling stuff and the like a lot of it actually comes down to biometrics, like, you know, are you getting enough sleep? You know, you and I've talked about this a lot, you know, trying to improve sleep quality and what are you eating, stress, all of these different allostatic loads, they call it, on your system. What are they doing to bias your decision making? And eventually we're going to have your Apple Watch or your Oura Ring or your Fitbit, whatever your device is of choice, port in your biometric data to then have that as part of the feed of like assigning you a decision readiness score. So you know, you're coming in, you're thinking about buying something. Let's check and make sure that you're in a great headspace, both biometrically and through some other ways, so that we know that you're not making a decision when you're stressed out, when you're hungry, when you're tired, because we know that there's like a million examples in psychology of how that can lead you astray and lead to suboptimal decision making. And the fact that we're not all already kind of checking our watch first before we like hit the limit of order in there or whatever we're doing, like that makes no sense to me. I think it's just like patently absurd that we don't keep more awareness about our internal body state when we are making decisions. So I think we have a lot to explore there still, but I think it's going to be really powerful when we do get it built.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I mean, I suspect that if you had my biometrics in March of 2020, they would not be a resting state.
There was a touch of stress happening.
Yeah, and you know what? Maybe the stress actually sharpened the spear, right? I think
could be.
I think I made some really good decisions then, and I think I made some bad ones after. And it would have been nice to have some of the biometric data behind some of those.
That is going to be very interesting to see. Sort of like the most laconical example of this is George Soros and his back pain, right? And he felt back pain for a number of days. Like that was his clue. That was his body telling him something he was missing. And he would like liquidate his portfolio because of that. I mean, it's a great story. I don't know how true it is. And I don't know if actually like that was good. Like did his portfolio, I'd love to see the data of actually like how did things go on prospectively from liquidation, those securities, did they do well or not? What I'm saying is that I'm not sure which way the arrow goes when it comes to if you had a pit in your stomach when you were hitting the buy, that might be the buy of a lifetime, right? Like,
yeah.
But
yeah.
We don't really know unless we start recording some of this stuff. And that's where I think it's going to be really powerful to see, are there signals in that noise of our what's called interoception, which is like your body's internal signals being like sent up to your brain to tell you like how it's feeling, like, you know, is my stomach kind of hurt? Or it's all of this like neurological feedback that comes into the brain that we then process as emotion, actually. So it'd be very interesting to see, is there signal in that noise that, you know, we all experience it, but we don't really keep track of it enough to know, is it telling us something important or not? And there's so much happening subconsciously, like that's below our level of recognition that like, I'd love to know more about what's happening under the covers of our brains than just purely like executive, you know, conscious thought.
Yeah. Yeah. It will be interesting to see how that develops. I think it's also somewhat interesting to think about like how one of the checklist items that I'm thinking about in my head is like, am I embarrassed to pitch this? Right. Because I think you're almost like saying this is so contrarian.
So that would be an affirmative then? Like if you're like, oh God, I would never want to talk about this publicly, that means you might be onto something.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think some of the better investments that I've made would fit in that. And I also think it's kind of interesting to think about like what would I have been embarrassed back in the day and what would I be embarrassed of today and how has that changed? And, you know, kind of, again, just how rational is it and how smart is that thought, right? And I think, I don't know, man, I'm super excited. I think you're going to get a lot of data and I think you're going to get a lot of people that use it that really like it. And, you know, some people won't, right? There's only so much you can do. You give people the tools.
True. One thing I'm really excited about too is to see a little bit of some of the like meta level data that starts to emerge. So imagine that, you know, and this probably, if we get a big enough user base going and you have...
When
we have a big enough user base. Imagine that you've like done a lot of work, you think, on an idea, and then you go to hit buy and it says, well, just so you know, you are in the 10th percentile of number of journal entries about this name. Or like, you know, you've spent 1/10 the time of the average journalistic user as far as that name is concerned. Like, how do I fit into the, you know, when I sit down at the poker table and like, where's the patsy? You know, a little bit of patsy detection might be very interesting to know as you go into it.
It'd be nice to toggle that on and off too, right? Because sometimes you may not want to know
true.
That.
Yes.
Yeah. That would be interesting to know. Like, dude, you have spent no time on this idea and you think, right? Like you are in the bottom 10 percentile of people that have spent time and your confidence interval is quite a bit higher than everybody else. And you may say, I don't care, right? But at least then you would have, you're not flying blind.
Right. And, you know, record why you're overriding, why you think that this is like, why the algorithm, which is what all that really is, why you think it's wrong. And that could be fine. Like you could say like, I know something that no one else knows about this. So, and I know this is the most important thing. Like I know the horse has a broken leg and no one else knows that. So.
Yeah, that's right. Or I only think this one thing matters. And then you can look back and say, oh boy, like Bud was something that I pitched a while back. And I remember it might have been Blind Arts. So there's a couple sharp accounts on Twitter that had followed it in the past and said, you know, you should really look at, like, really comp it to Heineken, like, do the work. And I thought I had, but I don't know, maybe I had and the outcome was bad. But I think there was a lot more FX risk than I really appreciated. And I think that, you know, what was interesting about that one is I ran past some yellow and maybe even red flags. And I think some of it was because of the amount of time that I had spent on it. You know, I almost didn't want to like lose that time. And I still do believe in a lot of the reasons that I bought it. But one of the things that I had a conversation with a buddy, and he said, you know, the problem with their craft beer strategy is when they buy a brewery, it's almost like when you buy a new car and you drive it off the lot, it's worth a lot less. Like as soon as Budweiser or AB InBev owns a craft brewery, it's no longer craft and it's lost a lot of its luster. And I knew, like, I had seen that to be true with Goose Island, and I had seen that to be true with a couple other ones that they had acquired. But I like Elysium, for example, like I don't think that IPA is what it was. And I just like ran past it. Right. So that's kind of interesting.
I mean, what you're highlighting is that the investment world, and because it's so connected to the real world, which is messy, it's a very wicked learning environment is what psychologist researchers would call it, which means that feedback is ambiguous. It's slow. It's inconsistent. And it's really hard to learn in a wicked feedback and wicked learning environment like that. So what you can do, hopefully, is by recording more of this stuff, you can make it a little bit more of a kind environment and at least start to see the patterns that emerge from things that consistently happen. But to expect our brains to untangle all of these different permutations and variables in real time and then remember what you were thinking about it 5 years ago when you were looking at it, like that's a really tall order. And it's just not how memory was. There was no reason to have a perfect memory on the savannah for millions of years like that. Like our memory is only good enough for what it needed at that time. Like, and nature abhors overbuilding in that way. And we all want to save glucose at the end of the day. Like that's what's happening in our brains. So in order to overcome some of that stuff, the technology of just writing some shit down is like hugely valuable and I think underrated even still, even though we've been doing it for thousands of years.
Yeah. How has decision, you know, recording changed your, I guess, the outcome of your process a little bit? Like have you said to yourself, I'm on the right path and I'm going to stick to my path, or have you morphed? I mean, everybody morphs as an investor a little bit, but I'd just be curious what you've learned about yourself.
Yeah. I'm trying not to, you know, 2021, well, really 2020, crazy year, right? Like, you know, 1 in 100 year type of pandemic shut the economy down. 2021, maybe one of the all-time insane bubbles happening. I think history will probably show. And then 2022, a lot of crash. So at the end of the day, any decision that was recorded at any one of those 3 years is going to have such a tide that's happened against it over a short period of time that everything has to be taken with a grain of salt right now, as far as like drawing too many conclusions from any of my baskets of decisions. So, you know, I'd almost want to put a pin in that for a few years and come back to it and see what the answer is. But in general, I think the forcing function of having to write down what my reasoning is exactly and knowing that I'm going to have to go read it later, even that alone is enough to make me work a little bit harder to clarify the thought, to synthesize a little bit more, and not like it's really easy to just be like, yeah, I think I got enough information. I'm good enough. Like, let's just go forward, right? Like, it's super easy to get to that point. And I, you know, another thing is I felt it, like I can feel when I start to want to say yes to an investment.
Yeah, so can I. Yeah.
And now I could feel myself like starting to like tip towards like, I'm going to go look for reasons for why this is a yes.
Yeah.
Which I think is maybe not the, like, that's not very good scientific method. Like, you should be looking for disconfirming evidence to your thesis. But it's hard not to do that.
It's also hard to know when wanting to say yes is your mind processing the first 20% of information that gets you 80% of the way there and is the right thing to do versus that next 30 or 40% that gives you the overconfidence that then you make the wrong bet. It's so complicated. The game is so complicated that I understand the merit in reducing the amount of decisions that you make, because the more decisions you make, the harder it seems to me the math gets further and further against your side than on your side.
Yeah. And there's this weird, like, what's the logical extrapolation of that then? Like, should you have a super concentrated portfolio if you're only making a few decisions?
I mean, my answer for me now is no. In my head, what I've told myself is like 15 equal weighted positions probably be the smartest portfolio I could put together.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if 15 is the right, and that's not the right number for everybody, obviously, right? But like, for me, I think I can get roughly close to where I need to be there. And I'm not trying to actually be a hedge fund Hall of Famer, right? I'm trying to get to the end of this
just
game.
Just survive and do okay. I agree. I think that's probably, you know, portfolio management is something we haven't really talked about yet. Like, we've been talking more individual security selection, but I think there's actually quite a bit of work in the decision space that's ignored on portfolio management. Like, that gets swept under the rug a lot. And like, we haven't built them yet, but I've got some ideas about what I'd like to see for myself as far as compare my portfolio performance to all of my names equally weighted. So like, let's look to see if does position sizing add any alpha there? And am I adding or subtracting? Like, I think I might actually be subtracting. My gut tells me, but I want to see the actual data of it. And over a long enough period of time, that should always caveat with that. But, and then also, actually, our mutual friend Drew Dixon has some pretty good white papers on this that he's written up about looking at his portfolio. And like, he'll actively trade around his names up and down throughout a year. And he'll run a couple different kind of assessments of that to see like, okay, was the name that we picked, was that a good name? And then how we sized it, is that right? And then how we traded around that over short time periods, did we add anything there? And so, you know, I think that if you're a little bit more of like a hedge fund, that, you know, they typically operate a little bit more like that, a little bit more active decisions within trading. And so having all of those automatically figured out for you would be kind of slick to just know, like, where am I adding value in this whole process chain?
You know, I think what's interesting about watching, I always say my perception of Buffett, because my perception changes over time. The more I learn, the more I realize I didn't know.
The more right he gets.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm like, oh, that guy really is a genius. You know, you watch, like, Alex Morris has talked about this with me. You watch what his Coke investment did and how, like, he never trimmed, and he's almost allowed incoming cash to reduce the position size of Coke, but he's not a big trimmer. And, you know, like, I have this big Microsoft position as a percentage of the portfolio because I inherited it. And I know I don't know more than the market on it. I know the market knows more than I know on it. Does it make sense to sell it? Does it make like, or do you just kind of keep something like that and say, probably doesn't make much sense to buy more until I get up to speed? Or like, just kind of, you know, you collect the dividends and go elsewhere with it. They're very complicated, I guess, decisions that come up over time when you hit a winner. And in this case, it wasn't even my winner, right? Which makes it a little bit even harder. But I do think I generally understand what I own.
That's a tough one, because it'd be really easy to, you look at that cost basis and you're like,
it's like a buck 30. Everything's taxable.
Everything's taxable, which makes the math even a little bit harder to swallow.
On the other hand, capital gains aren't exactly that high relative to history.
That's a good point. Yeah, you should probably think historically when it comes to that kind of stuff.
Yeah. If you think we have a lot of
trillion-dollar deficits,
you know, liabilities on the come that maybe need to be paid back, you could see a scenario where capital gains could go up substantially.
Well, imagine living in California where you see the wealth leaving, the liabilities staying, the asset base, you know, not necessarily growing the way that you might want, and just recognizing that, like, that bill is increasing for me probably as we move along.
Yeah, you guys need like another 10 years to get another hype cycle going. California is very good at capturing that every once in a while.
The bad news for you is that it's probably going to end up being a federal problem if it does become a problem.
Yeah, that's right.
I think we're all going to be on the hook for everybody's problems here.
Yeah, it is probably going to be a federal problem. You have read Zihan, right? Or Zahan, Zihan?
I did. I read, what is it, The End of the World is Just the Beginning?
Dude, it's not exciting stuff.
I mean, it's, if you're in the United States, it's not, doesn't seem quite so bad based on his findings. I mean, I'm not.
Very hard to argue it's bullish equity.
True.
For those that don't know, you're basically, every developed economy, according to him, is facing demographic cliffs. We have a shortage of working age population that can take care of those people. Those people tend to be living longer. Basically tells me get long pharma and inflation, right? Because, I mean, if his theory of the case is correct, the idea that wages aren't going to be sticky going forward, pretty hard to buy that. Like, I mean, I don't know if I said that correctly, but like, wages should be sticky. It should be a good time to be a worker.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know how much they're going to confiscate through taxes.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, there's a multivariate problems that are really hard to untangle. Like, that's why we're just macro tourists, but it yeah. certainly seems very important. I'd love to know the answers. And if I knew the answer, it would dramatically impact probably how I manage money. I just don't see how I can figure out the answer well enough to get comfortable with it.
Yeah, I think I'm sorry to any boomers that are listening, but this is my honest opinion. I don't think that boomers are going to sacrifice a lot in retirement. I think they're going to spend a lot. I think as a generation, they're not the most sacrificial generation. So I do think that I got to figure out how to get smart exposure to housing, like elderly housing. You know, watching what my grandma's gone through, man,
it's expensive to get old.
Expensive. Yeah. And there's going to have to be a way to give boomers a shared experience, like a community that's not a nursing home.
Like Soylent
Green. But you can
Green.
Spread the cost out. Yeah, that's right.
There's
yeah.
your shared experience.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But, you know, there's something like that. And people don't want to die. So they're going to, whatever drugs can keep them alive are going to have a structural, you know, none of this is a unique thought, right? But.
Well, I was going to say, it's definitely makes it harder to imagine that inflation doesn't stick around for quite a bit longer than maybe what you might anticipate, just because of the reverse of globalization playing out, like reshoring going to probably be more expensive, energy breaking up into multiple kind of energy supply chains. I mean, I don't know, like it just seems like that there's a lot of trends that had happened for most of our lifetimes. To go back to, by the way, I was like, I listened to the Bob Robotti podcast that you did.
He's the man.
And I was like, oh God, I got to come in after Bob, after he like drops, you know, 60 years worth of investing wisdom. And I show up like this jabroni, you know? But.
Well, I don't think so, man. I've said it now 3 times. You are the guy for this product. I know it. And Bob knows it too. Like the thing that you have going for you, in my opinion, Journalytic, is anyone that knows you has to be behind you on this because it's the right product. And I think you can help the investment community a lot. So anyway,
that
continue
would feel
with
good. Like,
your pejorative yeah. comments.
Well, I was just saying, I appreciate that, by the way. And I do think it would feel really good if, you know, like Munger's got this sense of like, I think that he feels good that he has actually caused a lot of rationality in the world through talking about his 25 behavioral or psychological biases that trip up people, to all the like ways that he's tried to make the world a more rational place. Like, I think he's very proud of that. And like the idea that if I could even just have a tiny version of that with a product like this, that like that would feel very good for me as well, in a sort of like leaving the world a little better than you found it sense.
Yeah, you will. I'm a little upset you didn't do it in 2017, because right now it sounds like your money losing SaaS, which would have been worth at least $1 billion.
I know that window of missed, you know, well, but in fairness, you know, you get 50 times revenue, but we're zero revenue. So that's, you know, 50 times zero is still zero.
We could make up a different metric. We could value you on eyeballs. You got a wealthy base of users. There's a lot we could do here.
There's a lot to spin the story up.
Yeah, we just got to get it to scale. We'll figure out the capital market.
When's
story
the next
later.
SPAC boom? That's what I need to know.
You know, these things can happen faster than you think. We'll see.
It'd be pretty amazing if we got another one of those off the ground anytime soon.
Yeah. You know, this SPAC thing has been interesting, because I thought the first thing that introduced me to SPACs was somebody SPAC'd, I think it was Bluebird Bus Company, you know, like the people that make the buses. And I was reading through that. I was like, oh my God, the founder shares are so cheap. And then, you know, like knowing Kyle, who does SPACs, and talking to Mike about it, I've realized, watching Liberty not do one, right, and they lost the risk capital, I've kind of realized it's a lot more nuanced. But boy, for a little while, that just became fucking pixie dust and grift.
Yeah, and it's
disgusting.
Not worked out well for the people who are holding some of those bags. That's rough.
Yeah, well, I am holding one of the bags, but not a lot of the
Thankfully,
bags.
Thankfully, just a one bagger. Yeah. Oh, is that what they've been talking about this whole time? A 10 bagger?
That's right. Yeah.
That means you've been holding 10 bags on the way down.
God. You know, it's so frustrating that I get so frustrated at, I mean, I don't even want to say it out loud, but it's true. Like, you know, Chamath, you know, it's awesome that he growth hacked social media for his bank account, right? But like, you see what that's done to the world. And then like all the retail grift during the SPAC boom, like it's just so upsetting.
It's
on so many levels.
Kind of a trail of destruction,
right? And he's
right?
accumulated so much during it, right? It's like, man, that's, I don't know, a fucked up result.
Yeah, I think we have to take some solace in that, you know, I think the universe eventually evens things out. And if you go around just taking, eventually there's some comeuppance. I don't know how it happens, but whether it's, you know, you get to the end and personally, like no one shows up for your funeral or what. I mean, it could be something that far away, but eventually grifters and takers, I'd like to believe that the universe evens some of that stuff out.
You know, when I listen to him, I do like him. I like his story. I mean, but that's part of why he can raise so much capital. It's not like a unique thought, right? People that are likable are usually the people that can take a lot. I don't know. It's frustrating to me.
Yeah.
And he's it wasn't just him, but he's sort of, you know, he was the guy on social media cheerleading GameStop and like clearly soliciting retail money. It's disgusting.
What do you think where's our regulatory apparatus and all of that stuff? Is this like, okay, I'm sorry, it's a big boy world and, you know, it's kind of dog eat dog, or should we do more to be protecting people?
I don't know the answer to that. I go really back and forth on it, and especially what I lived through and the consequences of it.
It's much more visceral for you.
Yeah, I think like, oh man, I don't know. I'm for people having access to... Like, it bothers me that rich people had access to private equity funds, and that in a time when rates went down, on a personal basis, rich people probably benefited more than those that didn't have money. On the other hand, you know, pension funds did allocate to these things. So it's not as if like the working class completely got cut out. But man, like when you start to see people talking about, boy, options trading is great because it democratizes access to products that rich people had. Rich people didn't get rich trading options. Like, shut the fuck up.
That's true.
Yeah. Like, really, that stuff really bothers me. And then when you have a company that's basically a casino that doesn't even invest in customer service and they're allowed to go public, like, and then the people that funded them are heralded as some visionaries, like, fuck that. That you just turned the market into gambling and didn't have any customer service. I don't respect that.
Yeah, I agree. And that, you know, that Keynes quote about if the allocation of capital in society is done in a gambling way, it's likely not to be done well. And that's, I think, a very true statement.
Yeah, you know, and then if those people like complain about regulation or whatever coming in, it's like, you're the reason we need regulation, you know?
You're the wolf at the door that we're trying to keep from getting into the hen house.
Yeah, like, I don't mind if Jake's doing something. I don't think he needs to be that regulated. You, on the other hand, need to be watched. So, I don't know. It's just very complicated questions.
Yeah.
Where do you stand on it now? I mean, all the crypto stuff, like, it was nuts.
Yeah, I go back and forth as well. It's sort of that, like, are you your brother's keeper? I mean, it's that same question that we've been trying to answer for thousands of years. And a younger version of myself that saw the world a lot more black and white would have been like, hey, man, this is just how it is, and like live and let die. And let's just have complete freedom on all this stuff. And I don't think I'm all the way over to like, you know, Munger's patriarchy where Munger knows best and therefore he's going to set the rules. And like society will then probably be run better because of like he knows like how to counteract some of their more base instincts. I'm not sure I'm fully on board with that either. So I'm like stuck in the middle now where I don't have a very good answer either way. Like I just know like both arguments to me seem overly simplistic. And these are just like super, super hard questions to figure out the right answers to.
I think it's hard to argue that the SEC didn't miss some things. And I guess from what I've watched, it seems like they've waited to see what breaks before prosecuting. And it seems,
I think that's always been the case, though. I mean, I think if I remember right, like at Enron, Skilling and Lay weren't prosecuted for like a couple of years after the bankruptcy. I think it probably just takes time to build a case, I assume.
Yeah.
And the barn door is fully open and the horse is miles away before the, you know, I mean, they're probably more like they don't prevent fires there. It's like it's already the house burned down. Everyone was lost inside. And then they come in and like, see, all right, what went wrong here?
Yeah. So then you get into the regulations and the fighting the last war. And it's like, okay, well, what are we doing here?
Yeah, true.
Because finance generally is pretty good at finding the next war to fight.
Well, that was one of the takeaways of reading Edward Chancellor's new book, The Price of Money or Price of Time. And
yeah,
what he said that basically, like, you could almost substitute in the word financial innovation for figuring out how to get around today's current set of regulations.
Yeah.
That's all that it ever is. Yeah. Like, and he's going back hundreds of years to make this claim.
Yeah, well, I mean, in its most basic form, right? You just, in general in finance, you're giving money out today to get more back in the future. And then it's, where are you in the capital stack? And everything else is just kind of a marketing package. Mm. I think.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Aesop, one in the hand, two in the bush.
Yeah. You know, and then Buffett goes into, so how many birds are you getting? When are you getting them? And it's so simple how he talks. And Dish is so prominent on my mind right now, because what I think is true is I think they're doing very interesting things with Spectrum and how, so they've designed their, it's called a ORAN, which is Open Radio Access Network, which basically means, like, in the past, the networks, the hardware and the software were made by the same manufacturer, and it was like slower to update. And they've open sourced a lot of the hardware buying and a lot of the software. I think one of their providers is Rakuten. And I listened to a podcast on The Verge that the guy was saying that in Japan, I believe he said it's 40% cheaper to operate the ORAN network that they have that's working. Right. So it's like, okay, here you have a technology that I think is superior and I think is cheaper. And you have an equity that is theoretically priced really cheaply. Right. On the other hand, they've got to divest a shrinking business that's probably overlevered. They've got to divest another business that's not great. And then you've got to sign up clients to switch to Dish Mobile or Boost Infinite is what it's called. And I get thinking about, OK, like, OK, how many birds are in the bush?
That's a lot of path dependency to the bush, too.
That's right. And like the younger me would have been like, well, it's cheap, I should buy this. And now I've begun, and I'm far from where I need to be, but I've begun to appreciate how much path dependency impacts what those birds are worth.
Do you think you could back into like what you think the probability of each one of those individual components is, and then like kind of like do some summation of a probabilistic outcome?
I don't think I've done
enough. I mean, it's almost
like
runner, yet. You know, I need like three cards in a row to.
Yeah. But like there are very smart people that are involved in that equity, and, you know, there are some insiders buying. Then it gets into, OK, well, like, do they have a view that's an inside view that they're and the outside view is smarter? Right. Or so the answer is no. It's in my too hard part.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's one of the decision codes. Right.
Yeah, definitely. That's an interesting one, because what it might reveal is that, yes, like the things that are too hard, like stay the hell away from them. Then that could totally be the answer that it tells you. It might also tell you that, boy, like there was a lot of gold in that too hard pile that you threw away. And if maybe a little bit more effort you put in might have revealed some of those nuggets, then it might be worth it to stick with it for a little bit longer. But you don't really know the answer to those two things until you have the data set.
Well, I'm going to keep doing calls on this thing because I'm fascinated whether or not I have a blind spot that actually impacts my cable investment, which would have that'd be a real problem, right? Yeah.
That'd be materially adverse.
Correct. So I actually want to have some analyst that's bullish Dish on in order to kind of like counteract the Moffitt episode. But I don't know. We'll see, man. But these are all the things, like, I can go through my feelings and I can say, okay, how are my feelings changing as I'm doing more research? And how does my feeling change after I do a call with somebody that's bullish? Or how does my feeling change after a call with somebody that's bearish? And how much am I influenced by what I'm hearing versus what I think to be true. Like, that's where I really think the power in this is.
So one of the ideas that we've had recently that is, I think is super fascinating, and I never really thought about it before, but imagine if you recorded a feeling after that call, right, that you have, and you're like, God, I'm kind of bulled up about this right now. And you record a positive feeling. Now imagine that we serve it back up to you in like a week or 2 weeks, and you just read through it again and reassess your feelings. My hunch is, yes, is that there's probably a decay, like there's a half-life to your excitement.
100%.
And like knowing what that is and knowing like, oh my God, I'm so biased when I hear a good story. If I come back to it with clear eyes and without, you know, being all worked up, like I have a somewhat different assessment of it. And tracking the feelings of how it changes over time on the same piece of information, I think is actually super interesting.
Yeah. And I think like for me, one of the things that I know about, well, I think I would be a reasonably good salesperson and am a reasonably good salesperson. But one of the downsides of being a reasonably good salespeople or person is they tend to be easily sold.
You can get excited about some shit, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I completely agree with you, right? And to measure that half-life and be like, okay, I am not allowed to make any decision on anything for 2 weeks after I talk to somebody.
Yeah, there's got to be a cooling off period here before I would ever make a decision. And how long is that half-life? Yeah. It probably varies for different people.
Yeah, it definitely does. Are you going to expand it into other segments of life, I wonder?
I mean, it would tickle me pink to, if there was some equivalent of Journalic that was being used for business capital allocation decisions. I think all of the same stuff applies. I think all of the same things that trip up decision makers happen in the business context, and maybe even more because there's, frankly, like the investment community is actually more open to change when it comes to that stuff and like trying to improve. And the business is a lot more making gut decisions and then having a bunch of people go find the numbers that support your gut that you already made. And you see it all the time, right? Like if you look at, if you're studying capital allocation of corporate America. So I think it would be so cool if I could like make a little dent in that universe someday, but I want to help investors first. And I think that's like, they're the ones who are more open to these type of tools and improvement processes. So, but eventually someday, I think that would be so fun and so cool.
Yeah. How I've seen this working for you, and my vision may not be your
vision,
but
what are the tea leaves saying, Bill?
I think you deservedly so could make a very good living in some sort of consulting role with helping people stick to process and decision making. And like, I guess the word that keeps coming to my head is like the purity of your process. I think people could spend a shit ton on you and get a shit ton more back. And I think Journalytic is a good free way to help people. And then I think you're worth a whole lot more than free.
Yeah, that's it. I think you're right that that could be true. Just trading time for money would be really tough for me at this stage of life.
Yeah, that I understand. Yeah. But I'll tell you what, you're not going to make it podcasting.
What?
If your podcasting monetization is anything like mine, this business could use a little bit of work.
Yeah, no doubt. It's a little slow on the revenue side.
Yeah. I have enjoyed it though. The benefits have been immense, I think.
Immense and non-monetary.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. I love when people talk about how many ads are on Value After Hours. And it's like, we don't see any of that. And I don't think Toby is showering himself in gold. So Google's just kind of taking it.
100%. Well, I don't know. Have you guys been getting paid? I don't think I have. So
I have not. No. I do appreciate the sponsor of this show, but, you know, it covers the cost.
Yeah. Not your time, though, right? I mean.
No, hell no. So, but
apparently
whatever.
Our time is not worth very much if we're just, we've just basically given away.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, look, there's some benefits to scale, I suppose, right? It's cost per 1,000 listens or whatever is the metrics, but I don't know. It's interesting.
You know what it is it's like the ultimate serendipity generator for life. Like it just creates all of these random, cool optionality events that you couldn't really make them happen otherwise. And that alone, just the novelty of it is worth all of the investment of the time and the heartache and the bullshit that you deal with, I think.
No, I 100% agree. It also, I mean, look, I think it, rightly or wrongly, and I have dabbled with Spotify stock in the past, but I mean, it rightly or wrongly, it got me out of that because I just look at I look at how hard it is to actually scale a podcast. And, you know, according to Wrapped or whatever, I think both Value After Hours and this are in the top 1% of podcasts. I mean, if that's the case.
Yeah. Like, but this is like, what winning looks like.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, obviously, you know, it's a power law, right? I mean, Patrick's podcast is massive, right? And We Study Billionaires is massive. But monetizing the long tail is tough. It's hard for me to understand why people would do podcasts that are not just sort of like marketing their business. And if you're just kind of marketing your business, I don't know that you really care about monetization that much, because it, by definition, is almost a tangential goal, right? It's not your primary focus.
No. And is that the content that people are really, you know, dying to hear also?
Well, I, you know, I think people like our content in general, but I don't know that they would like it if I had to flood it with ads to get myself paid, right? So that's the rub.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
The world has kind of like gone towards wanting free stuff too all the time. I mean, it's like, it's actually a really difficult bar to get over now to get someone to pay for something.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
that might be changing, though.
Maybe we should stop doing things for free.
Well, I think some of that a little bit is a, like, that's a zero rates environment creates that as well. Like, there's so much money chasing so many ideas and funding so many things that then don't require the marketplace to validate them necessarily with the transaction of revenue, that you end up with a flood of business ideas. And it is kind of it's an interesting thought experiment to imagine that low rates sort of overclock the natural biological, you know, evolutionary system of capitalism, so that you're sort of exploring more of the potential paths that like businesses could take because you have so many of them that are starting up. And, you know, a lot of them are no good, right? Like, how many like different scooter companies do we need? But you also maybe like you find some technology or some path that you wouldn't have otherwise, or it would have taken 5 more years to naturally find it under a normal rates environment. I don't know the answer to that. And I think there's a lot of pain involved as well in that overclocking the system. Like you end up with a lot of destruction of capital. But, you know, you could kind of make the argument that if you overclock it, you actually are sort of overclocking the environment as well. Like, one of the things we've talked about on the show is this idea of pace layers, like where some parts of the world are moving faster than others. And so, you know, like the commerce layer versus the governance layer versus the environmental layer, you know, if you're overclocking the commerce layer because of low rates, you're potentially putting more friction on the environmental layer. And, you know, if you were super ESG, you'd almost say like, well, shit, put rates at 6% then, because this is like only the projects that should probably get funded and have some chance of being sustainable. Like, there's going to be more of those than otherwise. And we won't be building a bunch of shit that we won't have scooters floating in the San Francisco Bay because, you know, people are like, well, this company sucks and it went bankrupt, and now they just are throwing them off this, you know, off the wharf into the bay.
You know, it's frustrating. Now that I live somewhere that I'm outdoors a lot, I've taken a much bigger interest in the environment than I did when I was in Chicago.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I think a little bit. And like, man, the amount of consumption and plastic like pisses me off, right? And part of the interest rate or part of the inflation problem is like, I just kind of want to be like, you know, if we could all just back off consumption a little bit and not just like all need to spend more, you know, and just kind of slow down a bit, we wouldn't be in some of the problems that we're in. But I mean, it's just not human nature. It's always just going to be a pie in the sky theory, but it is frustrating.
You know what's messed up about that is that instead of the answer of like, we should all, like us who were all born on third base, as far as human experience goes, we don't want to back off. We want to make the other 2 billion people on the planet not come near where our level of living is instead. And I find that to be kind of gross, actually, in sort of like a cosmic sense.
Well, you and I have talked about this on Value After Hours and our views on oil. And I get some hate mail over this. Like, people don't like my views that, like, I mean, foundationally, coal and oil are, if I was in an emerging market, I would not care at all about solar and wind. I'd be like, I need to get energy to my people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of how it works,
that's
right?
That's the truth. And I mean, that's what you see in China. Like, they're, if you look at CO2 emissions globally, like China is this huge outlier that's just cranking them out. And like, what, we're going to go tell a billion people, like, sorry, you can't have the stuff that we have in the West because we were so profligate in our usage of it for the last 100 years. And like, we built all this infrastructure and now we get to live these amazing lives and easy lives relative to the typical human throughout history. Then we're going to say, no, you can't do that now. Like, I just, like, there's a little bit of like, where do you get off thinking that you get to tell other people that type of thing?
Yeah. And I think too, like, you know, we've outsourced so much manufacturing to over there that to complain about that, I think it's almost like off balance sheet environmental liabilities 100%. That we've just kind of pushed, oh, yeah. Right? So nobody wants to spend what they'd need to spend to buy shoes that are made here or iPhones in a factory that people aren't jumping out of a window. But, you know, as long as I don't have to see it, then I can complain about them. It's, I don't know. It's bothersome. I'm guilty of it too. I'm not trying to say that I'm not, but it's just frustrating.
Yeah, no, me.
There's some hypocrisy.
For sure. I try to recognize my own hypocrisy in this as well.
yes, I'm an honest hypocrite.
I'm sure I'm in the, you know, we've talked before on the show about like, what does the amount of energy that you actually use, what would it look like if a human had to be the one that was like providing all of this and not an old dinosaur that decayed and then we tapped it? And the answer is like, in a developed world, like where we live, it's like 600 people that would be required to that many hands in the process to create your world that you live in. And you know, the global average is, I think, more around like 60 hands or like 50 hands. So we're already like 10x or more the what everyone else is doing on average. So it's sort of like, boy, pot calling the kettle black here in some ways.
And you know, the fucked up thing about it in a way is it seems to me that the more that people consume, I do not believe, well, there is most definitely a correlation between whether or not you can comfortably live and eat and happiness. But I'm convinced that once you get over at least a certain level, your happiness goes down. And I know there have been studies on it that show like a minimum level of like, what is it, 75? It's probably,
yeah, there's inflation.
You know,
let's call
grand
it
or whatever.
Call it 90 grand now or something. 90, yeah.
Yeah. But still, I mean, the more you consume, the more the stuff owns you. It's a bizarre thing.
I have a friend who, I'm not going to name him because I'm not sure he would want this attributed to him, but his theory of the case is that above that $90,000 threshold, most of the underlying motivation, that job to be done of what the consumption is a guy trying to get laid and whatever it is, or vice versa,
yeah.
or a woman. But
I would say it's slightly differently. I think it's covering up insecurity.
Mm. But that conspicuous
at least
consumption
for me it was.
Is covering up insecurity more than trying to procreate.
Yes. I mean, once people are married, right? I've also seen a lot of spending trying to cover up pain from childhood. Mm. But fundamentally, I don't think it comes from a strong place. I think it comes from a place of weakness.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Maybe wrong. I don't know. But
sounds right. So let's
that's
go
right. Yeah. So it is right. Boom. The wisdom. Well, anyway, man, I wanted to have you on the show. I wanted to plug Journalytic. We got into some life and I don't know, man, I love you. It's been fun to have, you know, a show together for 3 years and it's been really fun to watch you develop this product. And in case people didn't hear it, it's free. So they should check it out and provide feedback. And I'm excited for you.
Well, you know, I really appreciate it. And as you know, I also love you and our ability to bond every week for the last 4 seasons and coming into a fifth one here, I think it's been just such a treat. I think about how lucky it was that it all came together when it did for us. And, you know, life should always be full of those kind of like happy accidents if you can get them and lean into them.
Yeah. We lasted longer than 5 episodes.
I can't believe it.
Before long, we'll do 5 on this show ourselves.
Jeez. These are kind of fun though too, because we get to, it's a more leisurely pace than what we're doing, because you know, we're aiming for an hour with Value After Hours, and we know we have a certain amount of
Toby
things.
Toby is on it, man. 60 minutes hits and he's
it's
off.
Like he's catching a flight every, you know, like every week he's got somewhere to
I
go.
I get why, but it's sometimes it's like, dude, just let us go.
I know, we were just getting into some good shit and you cut us off.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Like, we get into the real meat, and he's like, and we'll see you next week.
The problem is that we never pick it back up and, like, you know, continue the thread. We always just start over.
That's right. Yeah. I was actually thinking about listening to some old shows and doing, like, a segment on this is what we said 2 years ago and whatever. It would be nice if some listeners would do that for me, though. I don't really have the time to do that, though. You know, true car stats, whatever.
I would love to have them, like, go back and look, especially probably the most likely place where there were going to be errors is when the world was most uncertain. Like, listen to all the shows in the spring of 2020 and then tell us all of the stupid things that we said. Like, I'd really like to know, like, what was the dumbest thing I said in 2020?
I don't know, man. I think that we were pretty good then. I think I probably said some stupid stuff a year later.
That was when it got stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think at that time we were pretty good.
Is this around
good.
Buying a Bored Ape?
I still am interested in that. I still think I'll own one eventually. I just, as I said, I think I'm going to either pay a very little bit or a lot.
And I want to own one now for the same reason that someone has, like, you know, Zimbabwe $1 trillion bills that they have. Like, it's the same kind of, like, yes. Memorial. Like, that's what I want it for.
Yeah, exactly. And I still think there's going to be really interesting stuff that comes out of crypto. Like, I do not think that there was no there. I just think it was the 90s and tech. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure I said dumb things. And after a year of a raging bull market, I'm certain that got into my head.
Well, you know, nothing dulls the senses like easy money, according to Buffett.
Yes, euphoria is nice. Nice to live through. The hangover
and
sucks.
And it feels the best right before the end.
That's right. Yes. Like being very drunk.
That's right.
So we'll see how long this hangover lasts. If it's anything like drinking, I think we've got a little bit longer to go.
That was a rager.
We were pretty drunk. It was a
rager. We were getting after it.
Yes, indeed, collectively. All right, man. Well, enjoy your vacation, and we'll see you when you come back.
Sounds good. Thanks, brother. Absolute necessary.